This is tape recording number 5503C30PLS, a public lecture given by L. Ron Hubbard on the 30th of March, 1955. The title of this lecture is Conquered Territory. It is 60 minutes long. Copyright 1955 by L. Ron Hubbard, all world performance rights reserved. This recording has been re-recorded by HCO Tape Section, St. Hill Manor, East Grinstead, Sussex, England.
How are you this evening?
Alive.
Yes. Alive. I'd like to talk to you this evening about a couple of things. Of course, I haven't very much to say, but I thought of giving you a lecture entitled Man, Past, Present, and No Future. And then I thought, well, actually, that might be too lugubrious, you know, to talk about man at all. So I just thought we'd talk about conquered territory. Dianetics, Scientology, and conquered territory. Now, there's hardly anything to put on this except 5 years. And there's been a few things occurred in the last 5 years, and I don't think I've ever given any real summary or rundown on what actually had occurred. But a few things happened. The first moment that Dianetics and Scientology entered the scene as such was really 1949. There'd been a few flurries up to that time of no great moment, but in 1949 things started to happen. In 1947, I wrote a pamphlet for use by the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association entitled Abnormal Dianetics. Today that is known as the original thesis. This was written purely as a summary and rundown of some research and investigation for use by the medical profession. The medical profession did not see why it had to know anything about the mind, didn't doubt that there might be something there in that thesis about the mind. The offices, their main offices in the Middle West, thought that very possibly there very well might be something in the material, but saw no reason why a medical doctor should be interested. And saw nothing they could possibly do with it because they didn't have any department of research and investigation with which to look over new developments. In view of the fact that I've always heard about the American Medical Association's Bureau of Investigation, well, I was rather flabbergasted, but there's a joke here. The Bureau of Investigation only looks over offenses by doctors and non-doctors. And that's their Bureau of Investigation. So they had no way to test the material, and whereas they saw no reason to doubt the fact that a nuclear physicist could possibly come up with some answers regarding human thought, in view of the fact that the entire field of thought had moved over into the sphere of electronic brains and things like this, they saw no reason why there shouldn't be an answer there. They yet could do nothing about it, saw no reason why they should do anything about it. And apathy, apathy, apathy. Well, so I submitted the material to the American Psychiatric Association, and they mailed it around to some of their offices. I was quite startled to find that the American Psychiatric Association is a stock company. It isn't a number of psychiatrists banded together. It's a stock company, and a lot of people own shares in it. And the people are not necessarily psychiatrists. And they have no method of viewing any material about the mind or passing any opinion upon it or have any interest in it at all. That was a great shock to me. I thought the American Psychiatric Association was an association of psychiatrists, and it wasn't a stock company. And as a matter of fact, while I was talking to them in their offices in the East and talked it over with them, one of their salesmen approached me and asked me if I wouldn't like to buy several shares in the organization. So I had one of my pals, always have connections, that's my motto, I had one of my pals down in Wall Street take a quick look around and find out how much it would cost to buy up the controlling interest of the American Psychiatric Association, and found out it would only cost $58,000. Figuring that it was already owned then, and not having $58,000 at the moment, I, by the way, had lost my loaded dice and marked cards and other sources of revenue. We had to let that one go by. So here sat a body of information. To whom or where should this body of information be submitted? There must be some place in the land that had some interest in the field of the mind. So I thought, well, there's another organization called the American Psychological Association. Although it's a small organization and so forth, psychology by definition is a subject which does research of the mind. They'd probably be interested in this. So I sent them a lengthy report. I didn't submit the thesis. I merely sent them a lengthy report. And they wrote me back a letter and thanked me very much for the report. And so I said, wrote another letter and asked them if they didn't want to know some more about it. And they were very happy to send me back a postal card acknowledging the receipt of that. And that was death for them as far as I can understand, because I never got another stir out of them. They had no objection to somebody knowing something or doing something. In fact, they weren't worried or upset in any way about anybody doing any research. But there was no channel. See? No channel. So I then made it my business to find out what the University of Blank did with its information. And it filed it. And I looked around and tried to find out what were the channels of communication regarding research and investigation in the field of the humanities, and I discovered there was none. And that was the dawn of Dianetics and Scientology. Up to that time, it hardly even had a name. But in the absence of a channel of communication, there was only one thing which an individual could do if he was able to do anything about the mind. Now, mind you, at the time I really did something active about this, I had been active in the Savannah Medical Center and had treated a number of people there, quite a series of cases. I had worked quite extensively and practically with this information, so there was no place to go except to release the information generally. So through 1949, I continued the research and investigation and got into the stage of organization whereby it could be presented to the general public. In other words, a communication line had to be created for the dissemination of any information about the field of the human mind. The last communication line which was created actively of this nature was created by William James in, I think, 1898. And that gave rise, really, was the thing which gave rise, you wrote a book, forgotten the name of the book, some technical name, gave rise to all of these psychology departments you see parked around in the various universities. And that was simply a book addressed to men who had some little learning so they might think about the subject of the mind. And that's the only bump the psychology ever got to amount to anything. So, actually, psychology, for any prominence it had, was created in the same channel. All right. In early 1950, had the manuscript ready. It was published May the 9th. And we're coming right up on that anniversary. May the 9th, 1950. And that book was called Dianetics, Modern Science, and Mental Health. The book, however, was preceded by another book. And almost anybody thinks of Dianetics, Modern Science, and Mental Health as being the first book on Dianetics and Scientology. It was not. The first book was this book we now call the original thesis, because in its manuscript form, it was being forwarded all over the world by people who were copying it off on typewriters, hectograph, mimeograph. I have seen editions of it which were the most scrambled mess you ever saw, because they were fifth-hand copies. There are people across the world right now that don't know that a single further step was made than that original thesis. And the mail started to arrive as a result of that book. The mail came in heavier and heavier doses, and finally a psychiatric textbook house offered to publish a book on the subject, and that was Dianetics, Modern Science, and Mental Health. But this other book is still kicking around the world. A very short time ago, I heard of it newly. A fellow came in and said, I didn't know there was anything else written, and I was very, very glad to have an additional piece of information on Dianetics. And this book, Dianetics, Modern Science and Mental Health, is quite an advance over that earlier work you had. I'm glad we have a modern work. 5 years old. Well, all right. Here is just a slight summation. As soon as the book was published, mail volume increased so alarmingly it was necessary to make some kind of an organization. A number of, I suppose, respectable businessmen, representative of various professions, got together and formed a foundation called the Hubbard Dianetic Research Foundation of Elizabeth, New Jersey. I did not control that organization. I merely had one vote on a board of trustees of 7. The organization continued forward and was eventually sold out by its trustees to a fellow in the Middle West who did not pay the bills of the organization as he said he would do, and who threw the organization, in order to get personal ownership of it, into bankruptcy and bought it out of the bankruptcy court. Now, that organizationally might have dead-ended right there if 2.5, 3 years ago, with a very good friend and attorney here in Phoenix taking charge of the legal picture and getting it straightened out, that might have dead-ended all organizations on this subject. That would have been that. But organized by that time, more information had developed, organized the Hubbard Association of Scientologists, and that was incorporated in Arizona. And that organization carried on and was really the first organization over which I myself had any control, any real control. Now, that organization has carried on forward. It's changed its name to Hubbard Association Scientologists International, but it is about 3 years old, more or less, and it's been right here in Phoenix. And that organization has gone forward, disseminating information, taking care of, servicing the data on this subject. Now, why is it necessary for an organization to exist? Well, I've just told you there was no communication line for data on the subject of the mind or research and investigation in that field. This is very, very much the case. Anybody who has any data on the subject has to publish it himself, more or less, and this has made a great deal of confusion since nobody's tried to correlate this information. The Hubbard Association of Scientologists and the earlier foundation actually tried to coordinate information, and in many instances has solicited or taken under its wing data developed independently by people across the country. And where any of this data was of any use whatsoever, it has tried to use that data. It has also given credit for data so developed. There are a couple of books right now in the foundation files that were authored by independent researchers. We were instrumental, for instance, in California in putting out a monograph by a fellow by the name of Bulkley, who had a biographical approach. There was no agreement between Bulkley's work and Dianetics, but we had already formed a communication line. Now, a great many copies of that monograph were released, and whatever the war between Bulkley's theories and Dianetics and so on, it had nothing to do with it. The organization there was perfectly willing to act as a communication line. The information on e-therapy was also shot in to the foundation, was tested and found dangerous, and was blocked, and e-therapy came up on its own independent communication line. Actually, it would have been far better for the organization simply at the time, over the dead bodies of the trustees, as I tried to do at that time, simply publish anything anybody sent in about the human mind. You see, this wide open communication line, because there was no communication line. Well, that is not a very fascinating background. It merely tells you what happened to organizations. Anything that gets in contact with man is liable to get a little bit chaotic. And they did, more or less, from time to time, get chaotic. But they are straightened out, and these organizations are now all together. The Hubbard Dianetic Research Foundation is again in full action and is part of this picture of organizations right here in Phoenix. The headquarters of these organizations are in Phoenix, and these organizations have representatives now all over the world. The newest office going in for the organization is going into Australia at this moment. Person right here in the audience at this moment instrumental in creating that office. But the organizational picture is one thing. Let's take a look at this communication line. It's very self-centered of us to keep on talking about, well, we did Dianetics, you know, and how wonderful we are, and all that sort of thing. But let's be a little less passionate about things, a little less introverted, and let's just take a look at an organization called Man and find out that for all of his vaunted scientific bents, for all of his printing presses, his magazines, for all of his internal organizations, not to have any organized clear channel for data and discoveries of value to man tells you at once where the ball opened. What kind of a state was man in 1947? That gives you some sort of an estimate, then, how far we have come. No communication. The organizations in charge of healing in the United States, without any department amongst them to evaluate or publish information about healing, regardless of the mark. Fantastic. You mean the American Medical Association cannot furnish its members with any data? That they leave it all up to Abbott and Lilly and Park and Davis? Who have, let us say, some commercial interest in what they publish? That the organization really in charge of the healing of all insane and so forth, that this outfit at its highest level might give its mailing list to people who manufacture electric shock machines. You know, so they could disseminate their advertising. No, there we have to take it. We have to look at a society which one way or the other had tumbled along quite a distance without any real plan forward progress. No wonder man here and there is in trouble. No wonder he is sick in some places where he shouldn't be. If no communication line exists in the field of healing, then it must be the vested interests in various things which are simply financially remunerative can then foist off upon 2 billion people, which is a fact, any kind of a cocked up concoction you could name and say, well, this is it. The federal government has the Pure Food and Drug Act, but I'm sure that's mostly to do with what's on the label. I'll give you an idea of how the Pure Food and Drug Act acts. There's a girl by the name of Lydia Pinkham. And Lydia... Lydia was a boon to the human race, there is no doubt about it. But the vegetable compound on investigation by the federal government was discovered to not do anything for anybody. It was kind of a hypnotic thing. If you read enough advertisements why you didn't have this particular trouble, she was worried about it. So the savior of the human race, Lydia Pinkham, was able to put out a compound to the public at considerable cost to the public, which was not in any way beneficial. So the federal government jumped up and down and screamed and took it into court and fined them some vast sum because of their advertising and so forth. And they changed their advertising and went back on the market again and are selling it to this day. They changed the wording in their advertising. That's the totality of effect as far as the federal government is concerned. Well, we do realize that the Pure Food and Drug Act does restrain and does restrain various wildcat products of one kind or another, or misinformation from appearing, but we find it isn't very effective over a very long period of time. In fact, if they investigated a great many of these antibiotics, took it out of the field of opinion where it seems to lie right now, and actually went on a concerted research and investigation of this, then we would have some information about an antibiotic. Man, in other words, was in 1947 sufficiently disorganized so that if he knew anything, there was very little chance of it being relayed to his next door neighbor unless somebody made a tremendous effort over the dead bodies of a great many vested interests. So that's an interesting state of affairs, isn't it? Very interesting state of affairs. We would say then the society was not in very good shape. Its scientific information could not be disseminated in an orderly fashion. Now, it's not just information on the mind or healing that was in this condition in 1947. I had a very, very good friend, Robert Heinlein, who was in,
addition to being a very good author, is an excellent engineer. Robert Heinlein was at work in the Philadelphia Navy Yard, and he had this interesting experience. They got interested sometime during the war in reaction engines. The Russians had been interested in them in 1930, and other people had been interested. But we got interested finally, and sometime during World War II, and we had to know something about this. So there's a thing called orifice pressures, the measurement of orifice pressures. In other words, what size opening do you have in a rocket to accommodate what velocity for the maximum amount of forward thrust? In other words, do we make the hole in the back of a rocket 2 inches? Or do we make it 1 inch? Or do we make it 1/4 inch? And if we made it these various sizes, would it be more efficient? That is to say, would the rocket go further and faster on a smaller amount of fuel? Well, you could see that this is the heart of a reaction engine. All a reaction engine is a nozzle heading that way. Which engine is supposed to drive something that way? That's all there is to it. So if you don't know what size to make this orifice, you don't know anything. 1944-45, Bob Heinlein in the Philadelphia Navy Yard Research Labs had this amusing experience. He wanted to know if anybody had concocted a table of orifice pressures, which would tell you what size to make the back of the rocket. Had anybody ever calculated this in any way? Because all he could find were some tables made up by fire engine companies. You know, squirting the hose. And these tables were not adequate to drive a big rocket ship or something. I don't know what they were going to do toward the end of the war. Toward the end of wars, general staffs get kind of silly, you know. Even Churchill was getting rather silly. FDR and Churchill and several big wigs, including Eisenhower, I think, had a project toward the end of World War II, which was to float an enormous iceberg of vast size, many square miles of surface, and float that down in through the North Sea and so make a bridge between England and Europe so as to make their invasion. And this was Operation Iceberg, and it's still thoroughly on record. It didn't occur to anybody until after they'd sent out the many scouting expeditions to discover the whereabouts of a suitable iceberg that 7/8 of an iceberg is below water, and the channel, the English Channel, is not that deep. You just couldn't have put anything in there that would have supported anything other than that. Well, they get rather silly toward the end of wars, but this sort of capped at this experience that Bob had. He was given this table of fire hose pressures. And so he started riding around all over the country to find somebody who knew something about fire hoses. So he did this, and he couldn't find anybody knew anything more about fire hoses than he already knew. So he decided that maybe there were some independent workers throughout the country that he could get in contact with who really had tested some rockets of various sizes so they could tell him. And so he went looking for the expert, and having the facilities of the research laboratory office and all the secretaries. You know, during the war, another funny thing happens. They keep stacking up secretaries. And they just keep racking them up, more and more secretaries. You can almost tell, walking into the offices of the military during a war, how long the war has gone on. You just count the number of secretaries they have. And the number of people based at home, that also tells you, too. It gets larger and larger. The same people are out on the front. I mean, that never changes. I mean, they send 500,000 men out to do the fighting. In the end of the war, the men are still out there, and there's still 500,000. They're still doing the fighting. That's right. But the shore bases get awfully populous. And so he sent these letters all around, and he had this huge battery of secretaries, you see, capable of writing practically everybody in the United States, trying to find an expert on reaction engines. And finally, he got back 5 or 6 very enthusiastic replies from big universities throughout the country, and they said there was such an expert, and his name was Robert Heinlein, and he lived in Philadelphia. This is the state of communication lines. Well, the truth of the matter, although some people might think to the contrary, we have at least laid the groundwork for a scientific communication line in our organizations. Now, it's merely on paper. I mean, it's just there intentionally. But we have then envisioned this in our conquered territory today. that we have seen the lack of an adequate communication line to communicate new scientific information to various parts of the world. And having seen that lack, have actually moved and have really done quite a little discussion on the possibility of an international copyright office, founding one, which would act as a communications crossroads so that an inventor or a research man writing into it could get the proper microfilm copies back on his particular work. But think of the size of this. We at least have seen that there is something necessary, and we at least have a plan of how it's going to be done, and we at least have a couple of personnel who are already, to some slight degree, engaged in doing just this. Now, that's something I've never announced, but we do have this in mind. That's an enormous advance. As advances for man go, that's an enormous advance. Let's take man politically and see how he's advanced politically in the last few years. He's got an organization together called the United Nations, and five big powers came in, each one with the power of vetoing the other four. And they said this was going to be something akin to the world government, and this was going to bring peace and stop everything, and the only thing it's done to date is involve everybody in war. They had no plan. Seems like a plan, kind of, is necessary before you go into action. They went into action before they had a plan, and so they don't have peace. So recently we have been subjected to the dust and radiation of some 38 atomic explosions over here a couple hundred miles away. Of course, that isn't dangerous to have a lot of atomic bombs going off. There's really nothing upsetting about all these bombs going off. And if anybody were to learn anything from these bombs, or if these bombs were to serve any purpose, I would be the last one to criticize sending them up. But I've been trying to find out why they've been exploding these bombs, and as near as I can find out, why it's to increase the dust content of the air. And if they did learn anything from exploding these bombs, somebody's going to put it in his sock or in the files, and there it's going to stay. Why? Because somebody doesn't dare open the communication line. If you close a communication line, you head an individual toward slavery, and you head science toward ignorance. Closed communication lines. The most dangerous thing you can have around is a shut communication line. And very long ago, it's processing pre-clear. Who, between sessions, had been told not to say anything to a certain person, not even to the auditor, had been told not to say anything about processing to a certain person. And the pre-clear, after that was told to the pre-clear, came back to the session and wouldn't run. Just acted potty. Perfectly capable of running, except for this one thing. Somebody had said, don't say anything. And that was the end of that pre-clear. We slugged through it and got it kind of knocked out because we were just guessing at what had happened, and then did find out what had happened and got the block released. And the moment that the block was released, the pre-clear in the next session ran well and was again intelligent, responsive, didn't have communication lags and so forth. But this pre-clear had somebody stand in front of him and say, you will not say anything about processing to another person. And that's all that had happened. And the pre-clear practically was cycled. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? It means a nation is as sane, and man is as sane as his communication lines are open, and he is as crazy as they are closed. So we've been vastly entertained here in Phoenix by 38 atomic bombs which were being blown off, possibly to keep the price of uranium up, or to entertain the news people, or to exercise Marines. Of course, that would be a worthy project. I like Marines, and they ought to have exciting things to do. But where is that information going to go? Supposing they collected vast quantities of information from exploding all these bombs. Where is it going to go? Down deep in somebody's impenetrably tangled file. And somebody interested in studying energy or studying various manifestations of life who needs data on radiation, if he wrote and begged and pleaded, would probably find out he was the expert.
the information collected and hidden